base for eradicating data and making sure it's unrecoverable. All very thorough and professional. We've looked into Accorso's background, and there's nothing to suggest that she had some hidden involvement in this, Kennedy said. I don't think there's any question that she was threatened and told to wipe the system after she delivered the files. The only reason we have the hard copy of the instructions is because they were stored in a filing cabinet that she didn't have access to. Speaking of which, Nash said, isn't the next release scheduled for today? Kennedy nodded. 10 minutes from now. Do you think it's still going to happen? Rapp said. If I had those files, I'd want to know what was in them before I splashed them across the net. Controlling information is more useful than releasing it. It'll go out, Dumont said, sounding typically confident. I know the level of encryption Rick used, and I can tell you it's not trivial. Even with unlimited resources, we're talking years to crack it. Maybe decades. So you're telling me that whoever has the files will just keep on going? They'll carry out Rick's plan to destroy the agency just the way he set it up, Rapp said. I didn't say that, Dumont responded. I think they're going to use the releases to track down the person sending them out, the person who has the encryption key.
That's possible, Rapp said.
Definitely. Every time our mystery man sends a file, it bounces all around the world on its way to the recipient. With every release, they can zero in a little tighter. How long until they find the person they're looking for? Kennedy said. Depends on their technological capability. But it's safe to say that at some point the person with the files is going to find the person with the encryption key, Nash said. And then they'll have instant access to everything Rick knew?
Yes. How long would it take you? Rapp asked.
With access to some of the NSA's bandwidth? Probably 3 releases. The room fell silent for a moment. Kennedy finally broke it. Marcus, I don't want you to ever repeat the question I'm about to ask you. Is that understood?
Sure.
What if the ISI has the files? He thought about it for a moment. I'm not an expert on their capabilities, so I'll have to confirm this, but I'd guess 4 releases. I doubt more than 5, and they'd have to be brain dead not to get it in 6.
We need to make sure no one ever puts those files together with the password to access them, Nash said. You understand what's at stake, right, Marcus? Our people's lives, and the lives of a whole lot of innocent civilians.
Dumont started looking uncomfortable, and Rapp felt a spark of grudging respect when Nash immediately reacted by taking his rhetoric down a notch. There was a fine line between motivating Dumont and paralyzing him.
You're the best at this, Marcus. You know that, and we know that. Whatever resources you need, you get. You want Utah? We'll hand you the keys to the NSA's building. You need $100 million in cash? Just tell us where to send the forklift. Right, Irene?
There are no secondary considerations, she agreed. This isn't our first priority, Marcus. It's our only priority.
Dumont nodded.
I have an idea, but I need to work through it in my head.
Nash glanced at the clock, confirming that it was a little over 2 minutes before Rickman's next file was scheduled to be released. He stood and threw an arm around the younger man's shoulders, leading him toward the door. Let's go down to your office and you can tell me all about it.
When they were gone, Rapp moved to the chair Nash had abandoned. Neither he nor Kennedy spoke while they waited for the quiet chime that would announce the arrival of Rickman's email. When it came, she turned her laptop partially toward him and opened the attached file. No video this time. Instead, it contained a detailed dossier on Farhan Hotaki, an Afghan who had helped the CIA fight al-Qaeda and obstruct the Taliban's efforts to drag his country back into the 11th century. This had been an easy one for Rick. He'd been Hotaki's handler. The dossier included names, dates, photographs, and account numbers, any one of which would have been enough to get the man decapitated.
Can we contact him? Rapp said.
Kennedy pulled up his information on her computer. We gave him a sat phone that he's supposed to always keep with him. There's a pre-designated text to warn him that he's been compromised and to direct him to a safe location. Rapp grabbed Kennedy's phone and began dialing.
What are you doing?
I know Hotaki. I've fought with him. He'll consider a text telling him to put his tail between his legs and run an insult. With every static-ridden ring, Rapp felt his anger and frustration grow.
Finally, a familiar voice came on.
Yes. You've been compromised. Mitch, is that you?
Listen to me, Farhan. You need to get to Extraction Point Delta. Do you understand? Delta. We'll have people there waiting for you.
No, I don't think so.
Can you not move? How long will you be able to hold up? I can be on a plane in half an hour.
It's good to hear your voice, Mitch,
Hotaki said, sounding infuriatingly unconcerned.
How long has it been? 2 years? You've been well?
We'll talk about it when you get stateside.
Oh, no. You have a beautiful country, I'm sure, but my home is here.
You like desert hellholes? How about Arizona? We'll get you a crappy house right on the border near the drug violence. You'll never even know you left.
That's very generous, but is it what you'd do, Mitch? If it was America and not Afghanistan being taken over by radicals, would you have the Europeans pick you up and give you a new home and a comfortable pension? No. Like you, I am alone. My family is dead, taken from me by the people I've sworn to stop.
Okay, forget the house. How about a job? A really dangerous one with lousy pay. I can almost guarantee you'll be dead in a year. Hotaki laughed.
I would like very much to fight with you again, Mitch. But I must decline. It's been a privilege to have known you.
The line went dead, and Rapp threw the handset hard enough to drag the phone off Kennedy's desk. Rickman's mixing it up like we thought, she said, as Rapp stalked back and forth across her office floor. With Safafi, he picked a critical asset and didn't give us time to get to him. Hotaki is the opposite. A relatively unimportant asset with...
Unimportant asset? Rapp shouted. He's an important man, Irene. I've bled with that guy. I watched his brother die in his arms.
I understand, Mitch, but you have to ask yourself why Rickman chose this particular Afghan fighter. There's no question that he's courageous, but there's also no question that he's largely inconsequential. I'd say it's because of your feelings toward him. Rick wants to hurt you, and he needs to keep you off balance. Rapp stopped pacing and forced Hotaki out of his mind for the moment. If the ISI is behind these releases now, who are we talking about specifically? This feels like something Durrani would pull, but I saw him die. What would you say about Ahmed Taj?
I'd say I've never been impressed.
Were you impressed when you first met me? It was an interesting question. The intelligence behind her eyes had been immediately clear, but would he have thought she was capable of the things she'd done since? No way. She hid behind that cool, polite exterior better than anyone else he'd ever met.
So you're saying there's more to him than he lets on?
I have no proof. But we both know that the ISI is operating too smoothly to be run by a man everyone agrees isn't up to the task. Rapp considered the theory and found the ramifications hard to fully wrap his mind around. If a bunch of jihadists got those files, it would be a disaster, but not Armageddon. The likelihood that they'd ever succeed in decrypting them was remote, and even if they did, they'd just dump them all onto the Internet in one chunk. Unimaginably destructive, but mercifully quick. The ISI was a completely different animal. Their chance of actually accessing the files was sky high. And worse, they had the resources to wield them to maximum effect. They'd keep the information close to their vest, using it to undermine America's intelligence efforts and sow the seeds of distrust between the United States and its allies. The agency would spend the next quarter century with no idea who to trust. She slid a single sheet of paper across her desk. I want you to take a look at this. He sat and scanned the names it contained. Only about 2/3 of them were recognizable, but it was enough to understand the importance of the list's order. So the people at the top are non-critical assets that Rick would definitely know about. At the bottom, you've got critical assets who he probably wouldn't have had access to. She nodded. I'm not sure it's worth much, though. Farhan Hotaki's name is near the top. That proved right. But Sitting Bull and the Iranian ambassador are near the bottom. We still haven't been able to determine how Rick got hold of their identities. On the surface, it seems impossible. Certainty is hard to come by in this business, particularly when Rickman was involved. Do you see anything on that list you disagree with? You're thinking about pulling people out? I'm not sure I have any choice at this point. We'll start at the top and quietly work our way down.
You can't pull them all. You'd do Rick's job for him. You'd collapse our entire network. Where are you drawing the line?
I haven't figured that out yet. Rapp grabbed a pen off her desk and began going down the list. At the seventh name, he stopped and crossed it out.
Gunham is a scumbag who's gone through over $1 million of our money and not given us shit in return. Let him burn.
He stopped again halfway down.
Prifty's given us some good intel, and I think he's got a lot more in him. He controls a pretty serious organized crime outfit in Albania. Petty stuff like tobacco smuggling and racketeering, but big money. Tell him to get back there until we straighten this out. His guys can protect him.
He handed the list back to her.
The rest I agree with, but are you sure this is a good idea? The video of Rickman being tortured already spooked a lot of people, and we've had a hard time keeping them from running for the nearest U.S. embassy. If it gets around that you're extracting people, we could end up getting stampeded by every sewer rat we ever gave $10 to.
To answer your question, no, she said. I'm not sure it's a good idea. Rick would have anticipated it. In fact, he might have been able to write out the list I just showed you verbatim. Every move I make, I have to wonder if I'm playing into his hands. She walked to a level 6 shredder and fed the page into it. We need to end this, Mitch. Now. Because tomorrow might be too late.
Chapter 42 Central Afghanistan. The ancient stone window frame had only a few shards of glass still clinging to it. Probably the result of an American bomb, but that was by no means a certainty. It could have been shattered in the 1980s by a Russian rocket, or even decades before that, in one of the tribal conflicts that predated either of Afghanistan's most recent invaders. Farhan Hotaki stood with his back pressed against the wall, looking down on the unpaved street below. The sun-baked car on the other side was well known to him. It hadn't run in years. The pedestrians were equally familiar, moving back and forth at the strangely unhurried pace of people aware that their lives offered few options. In the facing building, families he knew well were taking advantage of the quiet afternoon to go about the business of survival. The outward peacefulness of the scene was an illusion that would be short-lived. Joe Rickman had seen to that. It had been 5 years since Hotaki's family was murdered, but his hatred for the men responsible wasn't diminished. None of the killers were Afghan. They were mostly Saudi, with a few Egyptians and Lebanese. These outsiders came to his country to tell his people how to live, how to worship, and they butchered anyone who resisted their twisted view of Islam. Before Al-Qaeda had spilled over his country's borders, Hotaki had been a simple farmer. He lived in a remote region of Afghanistan, untouched by politics or technology or foreigners. He and his people had inhabited that place for more generations than anyone could remember. What had been built over the course of 1,000 years had taken less than an hour to destroy. He'd seen his sons beheaded, his wife and daughters raped and left to die from their wounds, and his village consumed by flames. Hotaki had been bound and on his knees when they'd finally come to kill him. The gun had been pressed to the side of his head, but the trigger was never pulled. Instead, they left him there among the blackened bodies of all those he had loved, the sound of their laughter ringing in his ears. It was shortly thereafter that he had joined with Mitch Rapp and the Americans. Not because he believed in their futile and unwelcome efforts to turn Afghanistan into a modern democracy. No. He'd simply seen them as a powerful ally in his quest to kill the men responsible for taking away his life. The Americans were a confused and naive people, but generally the champions of peace and stability. Occupations were not in their nature. Unlike the fanatics who had converged on his country, the Americans could be counted on to leave. A pickup truck appeared in the distance, slowing but continuing inevitably forward. The people on the street immediately recognized the armed men in the bed, as did he. Not foreigners, but almost as bad. They were members of a Taliban enclave who wanted to extend their influence over the tribal areas and subject Afghanistan to their fundamentalist stranglehold. the steps of his neighbors quickened as they scurried back to their homes. Otake opened a wooden crate at his feet as the rumble of the approaching vehicle mingled with the sound of people barricading their windows. He put on the flak jacket he found lying on top and retrieved a silver Desert Eagle 44 Magnum that had been a gift from Stan Hurley. A bit garish, but highly effective. Much like the man himself. He took the spare magazines but left the silencer and helmet. These men should hear the bullet that killed them. And they should see the face of the man who fired it. A nearly identical pickup filled with similar young men appeared on the other end of the street, but this one stopped. Clearly it was there to cut off the escape of the man they mistakenly thought was their prey. Otake knew that there would be no help from the Americans. As angry as he had sounded, Mitch Rapp could be trusted to respect his wishes. He knew what it was to lose loved ones in this endless war. And more than any other American Otake had met, he understood what it was to be Afghan. The first pickup continued forward, finally coming to a halt directly beneath his window. Was it arrogance or just complacency? The Taliban had elicited so much fear for so long, they had come to expect their targets to do nothing but cower and beg. On this occasion, they would be disappointed. He could hear them arguing and used the time to ponder his strategy. The handgun was hardly an appropriate weapon when faced with a truckload of armed men. He had an AK-47, but even that would leave a great deal to chance. Certainly, he would kill or wound a number of them, but the rest would take up positions across the street and in the stairwell leading to his apartment. He would be trapped. Finally, he selected a grenade. It was reported to have a 7-second delay, and he wondered how accurate that was. The Americans were normally quite precise about such things, but it didn't really matter. He didn't own a watch. Otake pulled the pin and began counting. What was the word the Americans used when they did this? It was one of their states. Mississippi, yes, that was it. When he got to 7, he held the grenade out the window and let go. Allah, in his infinite mercy, decided to smile on him. The explosive detonated just after Otake withdrew his hand behind the safety of the wall. It sent shrapnel raining down on the vehicle and the men in it, as well as disintegrating part of the window's upper frame in a cloud of eye-stinging dust and smoke. Beyond being entirely deaf, a relatively trivial problem since it was unlikely he would survive another 5 minutes, Otake was completely unharmed. He heard the spinning of tires on the south side of the street and threw himself out of the window. It was a 3-meter drop, but the bodies in the truck's bed provided a comfortable landing. He immediately leapt to the ground, pulling open the driver's door and dragging the man from behind the wheel. He was bleeding badly from his head and neck as a result of shrapnel that had penetrated the roof. Otake slid into the seat and shoved the accelerator to the floor. The vehicle fishtailed into the road as the other pickup closed from behind. The man in the passenger seat next to him suddenly regained consciousness and began asking what had happened in a panicked voice. He'd been blinded by the grenade and had no idea that his comrade was choking to death in the road behind them. Otake leaned across and threw open the passenger side door. He swung close to a cart full of hand-hewn cooking utensils and pushed the Taliban fighter out as they passed. The door caught the edge of the cart and nearly severed the man's legs as he fell to the street. The door was ruined, so Otake used the side of a building to shear it the rest of the way off. Automatic gunfire started behind him, and Otake swerved around a tight corner before skidding to a stop. He adjusted the mirror and pressed himself back into the seat, bracing himself as he waited. A few seconds later, the pickup chasing him came drifting around the corner. The driver, focused on aiming a submachine gun through his open window, realized too late that Otake was stopped in the road. The impact felt less powerful than expected, probably due to the considerable weight of the bodies in the back. His vehicle was propelled forward a few meters, and he gripped the wheel as two men flew over the top of him and landed in the road. Otake depressed the accelerator again, swerving in a lazy S pattern to run over the men as they tried to shake off the impact and rise to their feet. He hoped Allah would forgive him the intense pleasure he felt as they were pulled beneath his wheels. Chapter 43. CIA Headquarters, Langley, Virginia, USA. Irene Kennedy followed as Nash weaved confidently through the maze of cubicles. She'd never been in this part of the building, and its inhabitants' faces reflected that. At first, expressions ranged from mild shock to outright fear. By the time she neared the back wall, though, word had spread. Every head was down, focused on computer screens, phones, or whatever documents were at hand. Apparently, Marcus Dumond was starting to be affected by the pressure of the job he'd been tasked with, and Nash felt that dragging him up to the seventh floor would make matters worse. The hope was that Dumond would be more relaxed on his home turf. The office was what she'd expected, indeed what he'd asked for when he'd signed on. Nearly as big as hers, but windowless, it looked a bit like a garage sale right before the doors opened. There was nothing that even vaguely resembled office furniture. Paper files and books were stacked on a sagging ping-pong table. Vintage Lazy Boys provided seating, and there was an unmade twin bed beneath a Washington Redskins poster in the corner. Mitch Rapp was sitting on a threadbare sofa next to what appeared to be a week's worth of dirty clothes. He didn't look up from the Sports Illustrated he was reading when they entered. Dumond, on the other hand, jumped to attention and began tossing stuff off a recliner centered in the room. "That's all right," Kennedy said. "I can stand." "Are you sure?" She nodded. "I'm told you've come up with a plan, Marcus." "I guess. I mean, yes, I have." She was glad she hadn't insisted on him coming upstairs. Nash was right. She'd seen the young computer genius nervous before, but the deer-in-the-headlights look in his eyes was new. "I'm anxious to hear it. You know we have nothing but confidence in you, right, Marcus?"
"Yeah. Thanks," he said, before falling silent.
"Come on, big guy," Nash prompted. "It's a great idea. Tell Irene just like you told me."
"Okay. I still have friends who are, well, hackers. I mean, I don't do any of that stuff anymore. No way. But I've stayed in touch with a few people from back in the day." His gaze fell to the floor. "You know, here and there."
Kennedy just smiled blandly. It was an outrageous lie. Just last week, Dumond and a few of these friends had broken into the Walt Disney Studios site and replaced the new Star Wars trailer with a vulgar but beautifully produced interpretation of their own. As long as it was harmless fun and he covered his tracks, Kennedy wasn't inclined to intervene. In a way, the competition and cooperation with other hackers helped keep his skills sharp. While people on her end of the spy business tended to benefit from their years of experience, time worked against the tech gurus. Dumond's comment got more of a reaction from Rapp, who finally looked over the top of his magazine.
"Love the Star Wars video, asshole."
The young man froze.
"You know about that?"
Rapp scowled and went back to his article.
"Are we going to do this any time this year?"
Nash leaned into Dumond and spoke reassuringly in his ear. The hacker gave a few jerky nods and continued. "Rickman needed someone to send his files to the Russians or the Iranians or whoever, right? He'd have to find someone good enough to cover their tracks. And since they'd have to decrypt the data first, they'd also have to be kind of lunatic fringe, crooked enough not to care that the stuff they're handling could get people killed, and nuts enough to not care about pissing off the CIA.
"Your point?" Rapp said.
"It's a pretty short list. People smart enough to have a chance of keeping me off them, and big enough jerks to get involved."
"Do we have that list?" Kennedy asked. He slipped a piece of paper from his back pocket and carefully unfolded it. Kennedy took the damp page and scanned down it. "There must be 50 names here, and probably 30 nationalities."
"Yeah, but it's better than 7 billion names, which is what we've got now."
"So let's say our guy is on that list,"
Rapp said, putting down his magazine.
"How do we narrow it down?"
"I send out a phishing email."
Rapp's suspicion of technology had made him somewhat ignorant of it. In his mind, it was better to just stay away from things that evolved on an hourly schedule and could be grasped only by teenagers.
"Like the ones you get pretending to be your bank and asking for your password?"
"Exactly. We'd send a file from that Italian law firm's server to everyone on the list. The guy we're looking for would try to decrypt it, but I'd make it so it comes up corrupted. Whoever responds and asks for us to resend it
is the person we're looking for.
And you'd be able to trace that email?
If I'm ready for it and you were serious about giving me access to a whole lot of the NSA's bandwidth, yeah, I can trace it.
Kennedy was the first to raise an objection. 50 seems like a lot, Marcus. You hackers communicate, don't you? In private chat rooms and forums? Isn't it likely that someone will mention getting this email? And that other people will say they did too? Won't that raise suspicions?
It's definitely a risk, but it's the best thing I can come up with.
Why can't we narrow it down? Rapp said.
Everyone looked over at him.
How?
Nash asked.
Rick would pick the best one.
I agree, Kennedy said, but that's a subjective concept. What's best?
Rapp stood and took the list from her, spreading it out on the ping-pong table before motioning Dumont over.
Rick never made a move without knowing all the angles. He researched everything to death and had more contacts in more places than anyone in the agency.
I don't understand what you're getting at, Dumont said.
How many of these people are you friends with or have you collaborated with in the past? Rick would know we'd give you the lead on this, so it seems pretty unlikely that he'd hand the job to someone you're close to. Mark off all your friends.
Hey, Mitch, like I told you, the people on this list are pretty bent. I wouldn't hang out with guys who'd do something like this.
Rapp turned toward Dumont, and the hacker again let his eyes drift to the floor.
Look at me, Marcus.
Mitch, I...
You know what kind of people I deal with every day?
Yeah, I guess, he mumbled.
Then you'll believe me when I say that I couldn't give a fuck about a bunch of people running around stealing credit card numbers. What I care about, all I care about, is you putting me in front of this guy.
Dumont reluctantly pulled out a pen and began marking through names. It turned out to be more than Rapp would have guessed. When it was finished, there were only about 20 names left.
Mitch is right, Kennedy said, but let's take it one step further.
How many of the remaining people have you hurt, Marcus? Blocked, stolen from, or made look foolish? How many hate you enough that they'd fight you every step if you ever tried to get to them?
He scanned through the list. Maybe four?
Rapp tapped the page with his index finger.
Then that's where we start.
Rapp followed Irene Kennedy into her office and closed the door behind him.
What do you want to talk to me about?
Normally, Rapp avoided headquarters like the plague, and that day he'd been forced to take the full tour, public elevators, the basement, and more crowded hallways than he could count. As a man who valued anonymity beyond all other things, being gawked at and backslapped by half the agency wasn't going down well.
Please have a seat.
He would have preferred to stay close to the door, but there was a weight to Kennedy's tone that suggested the meeting was going to be neither quick nor easy.
What is it? He said, doing as she asked.
I have a meeting with the president, scheduled for later this afternoon.
Let me guess. Kamal Safavi?
Tensions between the United States and the Iranians continued to escalate, with accusations being flung from both sides. Tehran had completely shut down diplomatic relations, and President Alexander was talking about a new round of sanctions. In the meantime, the fledgling cooperation between the two countries with regard to controlling the Sunnis was dead in the water. Iran's one item on the agenda.
What are the others?
The Russians, Farhan Hotaki. The fact that someone has the Rickman files, and there's no way for us to be certain they haven't accessed them. What Rick knew and how he got that information.
Her voice trailed off. Rapp didn't envy her. There was nothing politicians liked to do more than Monday morning quarterback decisions that they themselves wouldn't have the guts to make. As long as things were going well and they were getting re-elected, they were content to stay in the background. But when things got tough, they didn't just abandon the sinking ship, they drilled holes in the hull on their way out.
Is that all?
No. I assume the subject of my resignation will come up.
You've got to be kidding.
I'm afraid not. We had a lot of history with President Hayes, but the situation with Alexander is completely different. He wants to do the right thing, but at some point, politics wins.
So we have the walls coming down around us, and they're going to install some political hack to make it look like they're reining us in? If he gets in my way, Irene, I swear I'll put a bullet in the back of his head.
I wish you wouldn't say things like that.
I'm not joking.
If anyone tries to stop me from turning this situation around, they're going to have serious problems. The choice between some wound-up bureaucrat and one of our guys in the field is pretty easy for me.
I think we can avoid it coming to that. With all the gridlock and posturing that goes along with getting a new director confirmed, a temporary head of the agency will have to be named. I think the president will strongly consider any recommendation I make.
I feel like you're giving up too easily, Irene. You almost sound okay with this.
I'm not giving up, but there's blood in the water, and I've made more than my share of enemies in Washington. It would be stupid for me to go to this meeting unprepared for the president to ask me to step down.
Who, then?
You're too controversial, and I assume you wouldn't take the job anyway.
I'd rather put a gun in my mouth.
Then, Mike Nash. Rapp didn't respond, instead leaning back in his chair and staring past Kennedy through the window behind her. He's the American hero you insisted on making him, Mitch. Any politician who takes a stand against him will run a serious public relations risk. While Rapp wasn't exactly enthusiastic about the idea, Kennedy was likely right. Nash had the resume, and despite a tendency toward moral paralysis, he was no coward. When it came time for things to get bloody, he could be counted on to be there.
Mike wouldn't be permanent, and I don't think he or anyone in Washington would want him to be, Kennedy continued. The goal here is to put someone in my chair who can keep the politicians off your back long enough for you to resolve the Rickman problem.
Rapp still didn't respond. Mitch, I need you to say something. If you can't work with him, technically for him, you have to tell me who you'd prefer.
Fine.
What does that mean?
It means that I might have to knock him on his ass a couple of times, but I can work with him.
For him, she repeated.
I said, fine.
She was visibly relieved. Like I said, I hope it won't come to that. But we have to be ready.
Yeah,
Rapp said, trying to swallow his anger. Putting Irene Kennedy out on the street with everything that was going on would be unimaginably stupid. The problem was that unimaginably stupid had become a job requirement in Washington. Chapter 44 Central Afghanistan. It was good to be out of the city. The air blowing through the missing door was still hot, despite the sunset 15 minutes before. Dust rising from the road swirled inside the cab, attacking Farhan Hotaki's eyes and working its way into his mouth. But it didn't bother him. In fact, he found it strangely nostalgic. A reminder of his life before the war, of days spent tending livestock and raising children. He had no photos of his village or his family. Cameras, as well as phones and computers, had been of little use to him then. They'd become part of his life only after he joined the fighting. Living a life cut off from the outside world was appealing in so many ways. The unchanging rhythm of it, the intimate familiarity with everything that made up his universe. He'd know nothing of economic swings, the internet, or nuclear weapons. Nothing of tensions between nations, pandemics, or environmental disasters. There had been only him, his people, and the vast empty land around them. It was a level of simplicity that should have been easy to preserve, one that would make his country of little interest to outside forces. For some reason, though, Afghanistan could never just retreat into its primitive insular culture. Would-be conquerors had come in seemingly endless waves since the dawn of history. In his lifetime, Afghanistan had endured the Russians, the Taliban, countless foreign terrorist groups, and now, the Americans. Why would Allah not let this rocky corner of the planet exist in peace? Why must there be constant tests of his people's faith? How many horrors would God force them to suffer before he was convinced of their devotion? Allahu Akbar, Hotaki said over the whistle of the wind. His growing habit of questioning the God he would be meeting later that night was the height of arrogance. Still, he hoped there would be some kind of explanation. He wanted so badly to understand. The stars were beginning to ignite, and he glanced down at the truck's gas gauge while there was still sufficient light. Less than a quarter of a tank.
He could extend the pickup's range by emptying the bodies from the bed, but it was unnecessary. There would be no return trip. Otake came over a small rise and saw the encampment he was looking for. There were a few modern lights, but most of the illumination was emanating from a bonfire in the central square. Behind were the mountains, black silhouettes that seemed to swallow the universe he'd only recently learned about. Otake rolled to a stop and examined the scene below. The village was simple, a rough circle crisscrossed with dirt roads and low stone houses. It was inhabited by a particularly brutal group of Taliban looking to reassert control. In his mind, it made them worse than the others. Outsiders owed Afghanistan nothing. If they had the power to conquer it, they had the right. These men, though, were murderers, killers of their own people. He pressed the accelerator and started down the back of the rise, suddenly free of the deep sadness that had plagued him since the death of his family. By the time he reached the curving wall surrounding the village, all that was left in him was hate.
"Stop!"
A man with an AK-47 appeared from the shadows and approached the truck. Otake had the headlights off in order to obscure the corpses he was hauling, but it was unlikely that the precaution was necessary. The guard wouldn't acknowledge even the possibility of danger. Like the men Otake had already killed that day, this one was confident in his righteousness and invincibility. The young man didn't even have his finger on the trigger of the weapon when he leaned toward the open window.
"Who are you?"
Otake answered by shoving a broken bottle he'd found on the floorboard into the man's neck. Surprise, more than fear or pain, froze him long enough for Otake to pull him partially through the window and hold his head as he bled. The dying man began to struggle, but he couldn't free the gun pinned between his chest and the door. Instead, he swung his fists, uselessly slamming them repeatedly into the cab's rusting metal as the life drained from him. When he finally went still, Otake released his body and pushed the truck's accelerator to the floor. The back wheels struggled for traction before catching and propelling him through the narrow opening in the wall. The village's men were right where he expected them to be, huddled around the central fire. They turned when they heard the approaching vehicle, but their eyes were adjusted to the glow of the flames and couldn't penetrate the darkness beyond. None realized what was happening until it was too late. He plowed into them, pulling some beneath his wheels and knocking others into the fire. The ones who managed to avoid being hit scattered. Smoke filled the cab as the oil-soaked chassis ignited. Otake leapt out, using an American-built AAC Honey Badger to spray the men trying to scurry away. It took only a moment for the pickup to be engulfed, and his advantage was lessened by the blinding glare. A round hit his flak jacket from behind, nearly knocking him off his feet. He spun, holding the trigger of his weapon down and sweeping from left to right. The scent of charred human flesh filled his nostrils as he charged forward, dodging the burning logs his arrival had strewn about. More rounds struck his vest, their force trying to drive him back. His thigh was hit, but the bullet missed the bone, weakening but not destabilizing his leg. A sudden burning in his neck and the subsequent taste of blood in his mouth heralded the death blow he'd known was coming. But it wasn't enough to stop him, not yet. He suddenly found himself amid the men. The flash from their gun barrels and the roar of automatic fire were all around him. He realized that his weapon was empty and dropped it, pulling the .44 Magnum from his waistband. He knew he was being repeatedly hit, but could no longer feel anything. Otake was vaguely aware that he had dropped to his knees and that his gun was again empty, but still he didn't stop. His finger continued to pull the trigger, tracking on the shifting shadows created by the firelight. Finally, the darkness descended. God is great. Chapter 45. The Presidential Palace, Islamabad, Pakistan.
"He's there, next to the kitchen entrance."
Ahmed Taj looked past his assistant toward a heavy-set American man in a dark suit. Having arrived in the country only that morning, he'd already taken command of the Secret Service team tasked with providing security for the American Secretary of State. Even the Pakistani detail seemed to be deferring to him, a shameful display of weakness that Taj would deal with later.
"Who is he?"
"Jack Warch,"
Kabir Gadai said quietly.
He's retired now, but he was the head of President Hayes's security when the White House was attacked years ago. Officially, he's here only as an advisor, but there's no question that he's in charge. They moved from their position beneath the ballroom's windows in order to let a banquet table be deposited there. Chairs were being brought in on wheeled pallets, and decorations were going up on the walls. Freshly polished silverware was arranged in velvet-lined boxes, and crystal glasses were being held to the light by kitchen staff in search of spots. President Chutani had spared no expense. This state dinner was to commemorate a new beginning in Pakistan's long relationship with the United States, and to demonstrate to Chutani's enemies the strength of his friendship with the most powerful country in the world. The real outcome would be quite different. Dramatic pictures of Chutani choking on his own blood while American security men drew their weapons would whip the country into a frenzy that Taj would ride to power.
Will Warch be a problem?
I don't anticipate it. He's inundated us with questions and requests, but I've been handling his demands personally. Obviously, his primary focus is on the safety of the American delegation.
What have we given him on Chef Marie?
Everything, Kadai responded, lowering his voice further. There's no information connecting the two of you, so there was no reason to make any alterations that could raise suspicion. The entire staff, including Obeid Marie, has already been cleared by the Americans. Taj tried to quell the nervousness growing in the pit of his stomach. His preparations had been painstaking, and Allah had smiled on them, he told himself. There was nothing to fear. On the other hand, perhaps it wasn't fear of failure that was eating at him. Maybe it was the inevitability of success. Much of his life had been consumed with the creation and implementation of this plan, and it was strangely disorienting to know that those machinations would soon be over. In 3 days, he would begin the violent but in all likelihood short battle for control of Pakistan. After that, he would have the power he had craved for so long. It was the much more difficult task of wielding his newfound power that was beginning to worry him. The Americans were not to be underestimated. They would fight the new order of things with every fiber of their being, doing everything possible to prevent him from asserting dominance over the Middle East. In the end, though, they would fail. President Saad Chutani entered through the east archway and stopped, taking in the activity around him with a satisfied smile. When his eyes fell on his intelligence director, he motioned. Taj scurried obediently to the politician's side.
"How are things going?" Chutani asked.
"No problems at all, Mr. President. I think you'll be happy in the coming weeks with a resolution to your press issues. And security preparations for the banquet are entirely satisfactory."
"You're certain? There's been a rise in terrorist activity in the north recently. Apparently the loss of Akhtar Durrani is still being felt by your organization."
In fact, Taj had far greater influence over Pakistan's radical elements than Durrani ever did.
"I'm confident, sir. The men you approved for this detail are some of the finest in Pakistan, and the people the Americans sent are quite impressive as well."
"We don't want to test those assertions, Amit. Even a thwarted attack would be a disaster. We need to demonstrate that we're in control and project Pakistan as a stable, modern country, a worthy ally for our American friends."
"I completely understand, sir."
The president waved to someone, and Taj glanced back to see the infamously volatile Obeid Marie jabbing one of the waitstaff in the chest. Spittle actually flew from his mouth as he berated the man. Most people thought it was the arrogance wrought from his restaurant receiving its third Michelin star, but Taj knew that wasn't true. Obeid had been this way since he was a child.
"Have you met the chef, Ahmed?"
"I haven't had the pleasure."
"Come, I'll introduce you."
Marie spotted them approaching and gave the man a shove toward the kitchen. When Pakistan's most renowned restaurateur turned toward them, his red face had turned respectful.
"Obeid," Chutani said, embracing the man. "I'm honored that you've come to personally oversee the setup." "Everything must be perfect, Mr. President, and I fear your staff is—"
His voice trailed off.
"Incompetent," Chutani said with a tolerant grin.
"I was going to say, in need of polish."
"I'm certain you were,"
the president indicated to Taj.
I don't think you've met Ahmed."
Marie extended his hand. To his credit, there wasn't so much as a hint of recognition in his eyes, only a slight nervousness that was hardly uncommon when faced with the head of the vaunted ISI.
"It's a pleasure, Director."
"The pleasure is mine."
Mari was from a village not far from where Taj had grown up. Their fathers had regular business dealings, and the two boys had known each other since they were toddlers. More important, Mari shared Taj's thirst for power and vision for Pakistan.
"Have you eaten at Obaid's restaurant?"
Chutani asked.
"I'm afraid I haven't had the opportunity."
"You must make the time. It's truly magnificent."
"Mr. President, please,"
Mari protested half-heartedly. Kabir Gadai appeared on the opposite side of the room and immediately began trying to get Taj's attention. Excellent timing, as usual. Mari was doing well with their meeting, but it was dangerous to put the man under too much stress. While he had enthusiastically agreed to be part of this plan, in the end, he was just a cook.
"Would you excuse me?" Taj said. "My assistant seems desperate to speak to me, and I want to make sure it's nothing urgent."
"Of course," Chutani said. "Thank you, Taj."
He started toward Gadai, who was disconnecting a call and slipping his phone into his pocket.
"We released another Rickman file this morning," he said, leaning into Taj's ear. "It was all we needed. Our people have tracked it to an internet service provider in Russia."
Taj nodded solemnly. It was another in a long line of miracles bestowed on him by God. There was no other explanation. He would soon control not only a nuclear arsenal, but America's entire intelligence network.
"I want you to go, personally."
"But—"
"No arguments, Kabir. I trust no one else in this matter."
"Of course," Gadai said, clearly reluctant, but wise enough not to press the issue. "My team is assembling as we speak."
Chapter 46. The White House, Washington, D.C., USA. When Irene Kennedy entered the Oval Office, President Josh Alexander immediately strode across the room to shake her hand. The former Alabama quarterback had the gait of an athlete despite having turned 51 a few months before. His sandy brown hair was still thick, and the elongated dimples that had so captivated the press were still noticeable when he smiled. Not everything was the same as when they'd first met, though. The suits that had been a bit too shiny now exuded understated elegance. Teeth that had been a few shades too white now were more in keeping with the constituents he served. And a little gray had cropped up at his temples, as there always seemed to with men in his position. Despite the fact that he kept as much political distance as he could from her, and even more so from Mitch Rapp, she admired the man. He understood and accepted that he couldn't stay entirely clean in the fight they were in.
"It's been too long," Alexander lied. "Always good to see you, Irene."
"I appreciate your time, Mr. President."
"You know Barbara and Carl?"
Barbara Lonsdale didn't get up from the sofa, but raised a hand in greeting. She was the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, and at one time had been the CIA's most rabid detractor. After her closest friend was killed in a terrorist attack, though, she'd had a change of heart. Carl Ferris, in contrast, did rise. He came toward her with his hand outstretched.
"I appreciate you including me on this," he said,
though he knew full well that she had nothing to do with approving the attendees at a White House meeting. Kennedy wondered how his new legal and marketing teams were coming along with spinning his relationship with the late Akhtar Durrani. The senator's arrogant smile and attempt to crush her hand suggested that their work was going well.
"I hope you don't mind," Alexander said. "Carl asked to be here, and I thought it wouldn't hurt to have the Judiciary Committee's input. More importantly, though, he's going to Pakistan with Sonny's delegation, and he's understandably concerned about his safety."
"Actually, I'm glad we're finally connecting. I've been trying to get in touch with him about his meeting with Ahmed Taj."
"Really?"
Alexander said, obviously surprised that Ferris had met the ISI director without his knowledge.
"My schedule since I got back has been extremely hectic, Director Kennedy, and the meeting was purely social. Ahmed invited me to his office for a drink."
A rather sloppy lie, since the man was a devout Muslim. It was far more likely that they discussed how expensive Ferris's new people would be and how they would be paid.
Everyone sat, and Alexander refrained from offering her tea, as was his custom. Undoubtedly, the oversight was intended as a subtle display of displeasure. One she'd pick up on, but that would be missed by the others.
"I know Irene won't mind if we dispense with the pleasantries and get right to business. The Rickman situation. First, let me say that trying to assign blame is a waste of time at this point, and very much not on the agenda. What we need to talk about is a resolution. Ignoring for the moment minor plays like Farhan Hotaki in Afghanistan, this thing has caused us serious problems with Russia and the Iranians."
"A complete disaster," Ferris added. Alexander frowned at the interruption. There was no love lost between him and the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, but Ferris was a powerful man, and he couldn't be ignored.
"Now I'm told we've had another leak this morning," Alexander continued. "In Saudi Arabia this time. Irene, could you brief us on that?"
She nodded respectfully. Mohammed Khatan, a high-level employee at Saudi Aramco, was exposed as a CIA informant. We were able to notify him, and he made it to the U.S. Embassy in Riyadh.
"Not necessarily helpful,"
Ferris interjected, struggling to sound solemn. While his thinly veiled glee was despicable under the circumstances, he wasn't wrong. Rickman had given them just enough time to warn the man, but not enough for an extraction. He'd wanted to create an international incident where the Saudis would demand their citizens' return and the United States would refuse. It had worked beautifully. The demonstrations around the embassy were growing in intensity and had the potential to turn violent at any moment.
"Irene," Alexander admonished, "we have an agreement with the Saudis that we don't spy on each other."
"Completely ignored by both sides," Barbara Lonsdale said, speaking for the first time in the meeting.
"True, but that mutual understanding only works when no one gets caught."
"With all due respect," Lonsdale said, "screw the Saudis. They're the biggest supporters of terror on the planet, and their treatment of women is beyond disgusting."
"They're also the major force in OPEC, and this country runs on oil," Ferris said. "You can make all the moral arguments you want, but the American people aren't ready for $10 a gallon gas."
"Look," the president said, leaning forward and propping his elbows on his knees. "We've dealt with the Russians, and the Saudis are going to kick up some dust that we can handle. The situation with the Iranians is different. It's going to set back our negotiations at least a year. But honestly, I've never been sure if those talks are going anywhere, or if I'm just falling on my political sword over nothing."
Alexander was being so understanding about Iran, less out of benevolence and more due to the fact that the angry protests from Tehran had actually strengthened him politically. The American people were skeptical about his outreach policy, and this demonstrated that he wasn't as naive about the country as his opponents charged. A rare miscalculation by Rickman.
"This can't continue, though. We can't spend the next 5 years chasing leaks and groveling to foreign governments."
When she didn't immediately answer, Ferris saw the chance he was waiting for.
"Dr. Kennedy told me that Akhtar Durrani had kidnapped Rickman and was torturing him for information. Based on the fact that classified documents keep getting released after both men's deaths, this appears to not be true."
She told him that in order to stop his grandstanding attempt to discredit the CIA. It had been a necessary measure to put out an immediate fire, but she'd known it would provide only brief cover. Perhaps she should have taken Rapp up on his offer to get rid of the problematic senator. "It appears that Joe Rickman became unbalanced," Kennedy admitted.
"You mean he's a traitor?" Ferris said.
"It's more complicated than that, but in the end, yes."
"I don't understand how something like this can happen," Ferris said, warming up to his subject. "First of all, why would he know anything about a Russian informant or an Iranian ambassador? Are you tacking top-secret files to the lunchroom bulletin board?"
"Spare us the soapbox speech," Barbara Lonsdale said.
Alexander, on the other hand, remained silent.
While he didn't want to assign blame, he wasn't above letting someone else do it.
"What does the CIA do?" Ferris continued. "Spy on people, right? Isn't that its whole multi-billion dollar purpose? Why wasn't Rickman being watched? Why was he exempted?"
"This is a difficult business full of difficult people," Lonsdale said. "It happened. Now let's figure out how to fix it."
"You can downplay this all you want, Barbara, but it's a disaster. An ongoing disaster.
Apparently, Dr. Kennedy has no clue what Rickman knew or how he got the information. How many files are there? 10? 100? 1,000? And why would we think Rickman would lead with his best stuff? I wouldn't. What did he know that I don't? Hell, what did he know that President Alexander doesn't? What we've seen so far might just be the tip of the iceberg. But we don't know if that's the case, and neither does Dr. Kennedy. Are we certain that her other people and operations are secure? Because, with all due respect, she doesn't seem to know.
What are you proposing, Carl? Lonsdale said. Disbanding the CIA?
What do they really do for us? Ferris said. Occasionally solve a problem that they themselves created. At the very least, I think it's time to consider a complete restructuring of the organization.
Maybe we should get rid of the military while we're at it, Lonsdale said sarcastically.
Ferris shrugged. Almost $1 trillion a year, and they haven't been able to deliver a clear win since the Japanese surrendered in 45. Obviously, the United States needs a strong defensive force, but I wonder if that couldn't be achieved for half the current budget.
I think we're getting well off the subject at hand, Alexander said.
Ferris grinned. My apologies, Mr. President. As you know, I have a passion for theoretical tangents. Ferris could be dangerously charming when he chose to be. The very real prospect that he could become president and turn some of his bizarre philosophical musings into legislation was terrifying to Kennedy.
Irene, Alexander said, where are we with plugging these leaks?
We have a strong lead, and it's my hope that we'll be able to stop them shortly. The president was no happier with her response than she herself was.
I'm getting hammered on this, Irene. From our enemies, from our allies, from voters. And all you can give me is that you're working on it?
Rickman was a brilliant man, she said honestly. That's why he was in the position he was. I'm confident that we're going to resolve the issue, but I'm reluctant to make promises I may not be able to keep.
I suppose that's the end of that conversation, then, Alexander said, not bothering to hide his frustration. What about Sonny's delegation going to Pakistan? Things are looking pretty volatile over there, and I'm sure Carl would prefer not to find himself in the middle of a Taliban attack.
I'm really not that concerned, Ferris said. Kennedy noted his response with interest. Ferris cared only about himself, and had proven over and over to be a coward on virtually every level. His sudden lack of interest in his own safety flew in the face of everything she knew about the man.
The Secret Service is taking this very seriously, Kennedy said. And as you can imagine, the Pakistanis are putting their top people on President Chutani's detail. Again, though, if you're asking for guarantees, I can't provide them.
President Alexander glanced at his watch, hinting that the meeting was coming to a close.
I'm disappointed that we weren't able to accomplish more here today. Does anyone have any other questions?
About 1,000, Ferris said, but it seems that Dr. Kennedy can't answer any of them.
I'm confident that she'll be able to soon, Barbara Lonsdale said.
Alexander stood.
Thank you all for coming. Irene, could I have another moment of your time?
Lonsdale leaned into her as she passed.
Chin up, Irene.
Alexander went to his desk and sat, but didn't offer Kennedy a chair.
That didn't go well.
No, sir, it didn't. He spun a piece of paper on the blotter in front of him and slid it in her direction. It was immediately recognizable as the letter of resignation she signed on her first day as DCI. The president could accept it any time he chose, but instead he pulled it back and put it in a drawer. Point made.
I'm behind you, Irene. Your job is like mine, pretty much impossible. You have thousands of people working for you, and some of them aren't the most stable or cooperative in the world. It's a miracle things like this don't happen more often.
Thank you for the vote of confidence, sir.
Don't thank me too quickly. I'm not going to lie to you, Irene. This is bad. If I could think of a single person who could run the CIA better than you, you'd be looking for a job right now.
I understand, sir.
Then fix it, Irene. Not tomorrow, not next week. Do it now.
Chapter 47. South of Annapolis, Maryland, USA.
Mitch Rapp eased his Dodge Charger into the trees at the side of the dead-end road. He grabbed a pizza box and a six-pack of Coke from the passenger seat, but then couldn't bring himself to open the door. There was a reason he never came here. A lot of them. He wasn't sure how long he sat there, but finally he reached for the handle. Not so much because he was ready, but because it was about time for Mrs. Randall to start her afternoon walk. She was a nice old lady, but the last thing he needed was a woman in a tracksuit cooing sympathetically at him. 7 years of wind and rain had cleared out the loose ash, leaving only the blackened skeleton of what had once been his and Anna's home. The second floor was gone, as was most of one side, but there were still enough upright two-by-fours to conjure memories of what it had once been. Rapp headed for the only intact structure, a sooty brick fireplace standing against the cloudless sky. He chose a place behind it that would obscure him from the street, then unscrewed the top of a Coke and sat. Beer, maybe a whole case, would have been more appropriate, but it was time for him to give that up until he pulled his life together. The afternoon sun reflected off the water of Chesapeake Bay, and he squinted at the dock extending into the water. It looked like one of his neighbors had cleaned it up and taken over maintenance duties. He used to run off the end of it in the early mornings and pound out a 3-mile training swim. When he returned, he'd inevitably find Anna drinking coffee and reading through a teetering stack of newspapers. She'd feign surprise at how fast he was and then offer a less than heartfelt apology for not having started breakfast. That was usually followed by compliments about his cooking that were actually a thinly veiled effort to get him to whip up a couple of omelets. Rapp grabbed a piece of pizza and took a bite. Before Anna died, they'd started building a new house on a secluded lot outside the Beltway. The foundations were poured, and a few walls were framed, but that was all that had been done before he shut the project down. The general contractor had been calling, offering to finish it for cost. He was a decent guy who was hit hard by Anna's death and had been having a great time figuring out how to integrate all of Rapp's security measures. Maybe it was time to return his calls. The years had begun to run together in Rapp's mind. One crisis after another. Lost friends. Dead enemies. A lengthening list of wounds and injuries. Every day had become similar to the last. Every scenario, a familiar twist on one of the horrors that preceded it. But that might be about to change. President Alexander was a pragmatist, which made him easier to work with than the ideologues on either side of the aisle. But he was also a politician. If he saw the CIA becoming a threat to him, he'd move to deal with that threat. It was entirely possible that Kennedy would be out by the end of the day. If that happened, Rapp had decided that he would deal with the Rickman mess, and then get out. Without her to insulate him from politics, he would have killed half of Washington by now. That left a long and uncomfortably empty road ahead of him. What reason would he have to get out of bed in the morning? Thanks to his brother's investment skills, Rapp had more money than he could ever spend, and his resume wasn't one you took to an employment agency. There was no way he was going to hire himself out to one of the foreign governments that would undoubtedly come calling, and he couldn't picture himself protecting some celebrity or billionaire whom he'd just as soon shoot in the back of the head. While he didn't necessarily like what he did every day, at least it was quasi-legal and made a difference. Going back to triathlons would be an interesting challenge, but he had to be realistic. The years and bullet holes would make it impossible for him to return to the top level. And that was less a life than it was a time killer. The phone in his jacket began to vibrate, and he pulled it out. Mike Nash. Rapp let out a long breath and picked up.
Yeah.
She's out of her meeting with the president.
And?
Rumor has it that we're still gainfully employed. A sailboat came into view, and Rapp followed it with his eyes.
I guess that's good news.
Might not last long. He and Kennedy had decided not to tell Nash about his role in their succession plans. He had enough pressure bearing down on him, and they weren't sure how he'd handle more. There weren't many people better in combat, but running the agency was different. Having someone shooting at you was, in many ways, the simplest of problems. You knew who the enemy was, and you knew the issue was going to be quickly resolved in either your favor or the other guy's. Once you sat down in the DCI's chair, the shit came at you from every direction, and it never stopped.
Anything new with Rickman?
Maybe. A high-level asset disappeared in Venezuela.
No gloating?
No email, no video. Rick would keep changing things up to keep us guessing. We think that's what we're seeing here.
It seemed like a good bet.
Rickman had been well-connected in Venezuela through its membership in OPEC. Not that it mattered. He seemed to have had the ability to shine a light into any dark corner he wanted.
What about Marcus's phishing emails?
They've been sent, but we haven't gotten any responses yet.
Do you think they're on to us?
Not likely. Marcus is monitoring the chatter, and there hasn't been any mention of the emails. Hackers are a pretty secretive bunch, and for now that's working in our favor.
Yeah, but we're running out of time.
Maybe Irene didn't get her walking papers today, but she will next week, or the week after that.
I understand, but there's nothing we can do but wait.
This is our shot, Mitch. If it doesn't work...
His voice faded, and Rapp understood why.
They'd have to shut down virtually their entire network and walk away. In all likelihood, Congress would gut the CIA and piece out its duties to everyone from the FBI to the Park Service, all while America's enemies danced on the agency's grave.
Chapter 48. The White House, Washington, D.C., USA. Carl Ferris looked at the White House through the windows of his idling limousine. Activity was limited, consisting primarily of Secret Service agents and dogs patrolling the grounds. Dialing the satellite phone in the heightened security environment made him sweat a bit, but Ahmed Taj had assured him the encryption was unbreakable. Why doubt the man? The ISI had been playing America's intelligence agencies for fools for more than a decade. Predictably, Taj picked up on the first ring.
I trust the meeting went well.
Ferris confirmed that the barrier between him and his driver was sealed before responding.
Better than either of us expected. That icy bitch embarrassed herself more times than I can count. Rickman has her by the short hairs. I won't have to lift a finger. The great Irene Kennedy is going to get taken down by a corpse.
The president didn't ask for her resignation?
No, but he will soon. For some reason, he still has confidence in her, but he's not going to commit political suicide. No one has any idea what's in these files, and he knows he could be one release away from a scandal that will break his administration. Plausible deniability will only get you so far. When the American people see the CIA for what it really is, a bunch of psychotics who think they're above the law, he'll want to be as far from her as he can get.
I'm disappointed that she's still at Langley. But I trust your judgment, Taj said. With that woman and Mitch Rapp in place, we'll never be able to forge a relationship of trust and friendship between our two countries. I sincerely believe that it will be you and President Chutani who are remembered by history for laying the groundwork for peace in the region. I look forward to seeing you when you arrive with Secretary Wicker's delegation.
The line went dead, and Ferris put the phone back in his briefcase. The American people were tired of endless war and homeland security overreach. It was the right issue at the right time. Along with the Pakistani money quietly flowing into his campaign coffers, this was the platform he needed to take the leadership of his party and gain the presidential nomination. Once in the Oval Office, he'd pull the CIA's teeth one by one. America and Pakistan would stop their clandestine war against each other and join forces. Their fledgling partnership would allow him to do what his predecessors never could, stabilize the Middle East. There was a tap on the glass in front of him, and Ferris glanced up to see his driver motioning through the windshield at a woman walking down the White House steps. Ferris threw open his door but didn't get out of the vehicle.
A word, Dr. Kennedy?
She slowed, turning her dead eyes on him before managing an unconvincing smile. Of all the people Ferris had ever met, she was the one he hated the most. His uncanny ability to read people was the main reason he'd risen so meteorically through the political ranks. This woman gave away nothing. Even beneath the withering stare of the President of the United States, likely the only ally she had left, Kennedy portrayed only supernatural calm. She indicated for her driver to wait.
"Of course, Senator."
"Perhaps we could talk inside," he said, slipping deeper into his limousine. She followed, closing the door behind her. Normally, he'd move in a little too close, using his superior bulk to intimidate her. But in this case, it would work against him. The woman made him nervous, and her close relationship with Mitch Rapp amplified that nervousness to fear. It infuriated him that they could make him feel that way. He was likely the next leader of the free world, and Rapp was nothing but an $85,000-a-year thug. "It seems that our fortunes have reversed," he said. Irene Kennedy didn't respond to the senator's statement. She'd known many men like him, but very few whose pathological narcissism had reached this level. The lack of term limits allowed politicians to stay in their jobs long enough to be twisted by them, and Ferris was the current generation's best example of this. His ego had grown to the point that its tendrils had invaded every part of his mind.